From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. What kind of leader is our president?
We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides. On many sides.
That's President Trump speaking about the events in Charlottesville, Virginia. This hour we discuss his presidency and the meaning of populism. Beth Sutton tweets to us this morning, Charlottesville was my home for almost 10 years. I wish I could be outraged, but instead I am unspeakably sad. Sam Burnham tweets, Charlottesville was due to a gang of haters looking for a spotlight. A statue was their excuse, white supremacy their reason. All this hour, and in fact all day, all week, we welcome your thoughts, especially on Charlottesville. What do you think caused the tragic events over the weekend? What is our next step? And what do you expect leaders to do about what happened? Let us know. You know how to reach us at our phone number, 404-500-9457, or find us on social media. Last week, The Break Room talked about how believers perceive atheists.
Well, as a trans man who is often seen as other, and, you know, when people put it out there that because you're trans, you must be a predator, so you must be kept out of the restroom. Because you're an atheist, you're often looked at as other, especially kids.
That's Break Room regular Christian Zilovitz. Here are your first thoughts.
My name's Benjamin Dunson. I'm calling from Middle Georgia, Pineview. As an atheist growing up here in Middle Georgia, I'm 24 years old now. I had to deal with both the liberal left and the religious right. I'm a big fan of Ayn Rand, which of course makes me an atheist, but also right-wing, so it's hard for me to get along with either part of the political spectrum these days.
So you know how to get your thoughts to us, and we welcome them. Call us, just like Benjamin did, and leave a message there. Find us on Twitter, at OST Talk. And remember, we might feature your comments on the show. When Donald Trump announced his candidacy, many people didn't take him seriously. But Jared Yates Sexton did. He was one of the first people to witness and report on events from Trump's campaign rallies and identified a simmering rage in the United States that fueled Trump's campaign. Sexton is a professor of creative writing at Georgia Southern University and author of the new book, The People Are Going to Rise Like the Waters Upon Your Shore. The book examines the growth of rage in the American psyche, and Jared Yates Sexton joins me now from our Savannah Bureau. Hi, Jared.
Hi, good morning.
So we were going to spend most of our time talking about your book, and we're still going to do that. But it feels to me like the events in Charlottesville really sort of bring into further clarification many of the themes that you were talking about in the book. Is this the same rage that you wrote about that you saw in Virginia?
Yeah, unfortunately it is. I've talked to a lot of people over the past couple of days, and while the tragedy that happened in Charlottesville was terrible, it was not unpredictable. This has been a situation that's been gathering up over the past couple of years, and anybody who spent any amount of time at Donald Trump's rallies or events, I think, saw in a lot of his supporters, who many of them have been white supremacists, who had neo-Nazi shirts, neo-Nazi tattoos, who openly expressed these views, saw that there was an escalating situation inside of this campaign and inside of this movement that was eventually going to lead to violence, and unfortunately, that's what we've now seen.
So I want to play you this clip. This is a comment that Senator Bernie Sanders said in 2016, and he's explaining why he thinks Trump actually won last year.
What Trump did very effectively is tap the angst and the anger and the hurt and the pain that millions of working class people are feeling. And what he said is, I, Donald Trump, I'm going to be a champion of the working class. That's the word he used. I know you're working longer hours for low wages. You're seeing your jobs go to China. You can't afford child care, can't afford to send your kids to college. I, Donald Trump, alone, I can solve these problems.
Do you think it's fair that people are making this connection between white supremacists and Nazis in Charlottesville and Donald Trump? Is that fair?
Well, I think what we're looking at is sort of a divide that's been there for a while. We have a group of people, when we're always talking about economic anxiety or we're talking about working class whites in America, And then we're talking about white supremacists, and we're talking about neo-Nazis. I think the working class that Trump invigorated and turned into his base, at times, if they are misled, if they are provoked, I think that they have these really bad tendencies and instincts towards racism. And so I don't believe that all of his supporters are neo-Nazis, but he has certainly struck a chord with these white supremacists who have been able to essentially radicalize a group of people into action. We've seen this incredible growth among their ranks, and it's due in no small part, and they admit it openly, due to Donald Trump's success.
So let's hear a comment that Donald Trump made that people are now pointing to as one of the supposed dog whistles. In other words, they say this is him actually speaking to white supremacists. This is from a campaign rally last year.
When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're not sending you. They're not sending you. They're sending people that have lots of problems, and they're bringing those problems with us. They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists. And some, I assume, are good people.
What do you hear there? Were you at that rally? Because you went to a lot of them.
I was not at that one specifically, but that was a line that he repeated often. And one of the things that Donald Trump did, and one of the reasons why I lay a lot of the blame for Charlottesville at his feet, is he did the most dangerous and effective thing that you can do, which is to enable and excuse racism. One of the things you find among working class whites is a lot of people will say, I'm not racist, but, and they don't want to believe that they have these racist tendencies. And one thing that happened, especially after Steve Bannon came onto the Trump campaign, is you hear a lot of things which are like, well, not everybody's bad, but here's a group of people that are, which basically feeds into these negative stereotypes while also giving his base an excuse to say that they are not racist. And it's this sort of pronged approach, these dog whistles that I think were incredibly effective at capturing these people and, again, playing on their worst tendencies.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with writer and Georgia Southern professor Jared Yates Sexton. And I should point out that you are a professor of creative writing. How did you end up becoming a reporter? It's in the very beginning, one of the few people covering Trump's campaign rallies.
You know, now looking back, it feels like an entirely different life. But at the time when the 2016 campaign started kicking off, obviously in 2015, I just wanted to tackle this thing. I wanted some time away from writing fiction, and I thought I would spend a little bit of time writing some essays, possibly a book about this election. And I started going into these Donald Trump rallies, which are populated by a lot of people like me. I grew up working class, a working class white person, and so I recognized a lot of these people, and I could traffic inside and not really be noticed. And the thing that I found almost immediately was that this was becoming a safe space for people to say really awful, offensive things, and they fed off of each other. And the more that I went to these rallies and reported on it, the more I started being concerned about where this was leading, what the possibility was for this in the future. And so I started this off as sort of a thing to do on my days off, and I suddenly got thrown into it.
So, I know many Trump supporters who would say it is unfair to paint all Trump supporters with this racist brush. I supported Donald Trump for specific reasons that have nothing to do with white supremacy. So is there a coalition of people behind Trump and this sort of rage-filled person that you're describing and that you met at these rallies? Is that just a small percentage?
I think there's a lot of people, particularly among traditional conservatives, who what I would say was held their nose and voted for Trump. But I think in order to cast that ballot, specifically when he's out there saying these things about minorities, about vulnerable groups of people, I think that you have to make a decision that's unacceptable. I don't care about economics. I don't care about trade. If you have a candidate out there who's vilifying groups of people and saying this sort of racist drivel, you have to make your bed with that. You have to understand that this is what this person is about. And I think there are a lot of people who have sort of weighed these political choices and quite frankly, I think have made the wrong choice.
Well, then let's go back to where we are as Americans right now and what all this means. I think it's fair to say that Donald Trump is not the cause of this rage. You're saying he tapped into something that already existed. So where did this all start?
That's a That's a long answer. I'll try and summarize it as best as I can. There's been a long game in this country that goes back to the civil rights era, particularly with the Republican Party in this country, that has seen a necessary strategy in order to provoke these ideas of nativism, racism, certainly. And so we've seen decades of these dog whistles and these underlying narratives that are calling upon people's worst instincts. And
I want to interrupt you for just a second, only because I know there's a lot of people saying, hold on, wait a second. Many of the people that constructed Jim Crow and were the party of racism going back to the Civil War were the Democrats. And you're laying it at the feet of Republicans.
Yeah, there was definitely a shift. Strom Thurmond, the former senator from South Carolina, was one of the leading pushers of this entire switch. So there actually has been a monumental political switch in terms of, like, who is going after the South, particularly pushed by President Nixon during his time. So we have actually, like you've said, there were Jim Crow laws that were brought about by a Democratic Party, but we have seen a massive, massive shift, starting with President Nixon and moving forward to the days of Reagan, in fact, and even with George W. Bush. And I think that's where we've seen Donald Trump erupt, is we've actually seen that the strategy on the right has birthed a person who not only goes with this strategy, but actually believes it. And I think that that is one of the more troubling parts about this entire situation.
Now, most of your family voted for Trump, did they not?
That's correct.
And you have described them as preparing for an insurrection right now.
That's right. My family is the type who grew up believing in the New World Order, in these giant conspiracies that were all put in place to keep them down economically and socially. They've been prepping for years. They've been preparing for a new civil war, some sort of insurrection against the United Nations. And they have definitely heard loud and clear a lot of these dog whistles that have been thrown their way. And Donald Trump was a candidate who spoke a language that they were very familiar with.
Did that history with your family and knowing your family well, did that make you more likely to take all of these the incidences at campaign rallies more seriously or less so?
No, the one thing that I realized, and I started going to these Tea Party meetings back in 2010, and a lot of this language that started popping up in Donald Trump's rallies and among his supporters was very familiar to me. It was a lot of the same rhetoric. It was a lot of the same words, a lot of the same phrases that I had heard from my family and the people in my community in southern Indiana. And I started to realize that this wasn't isolated anymore. This wasn't taking place in living rooms and kitchens. It was coming out into the public sphere and was gaining political power.
We're going to continue talking about this, especially the you quote a cab driver in your book as saying, you ask me, what I want is somebody to get up there and just tell everyone to go bleep themselves. And it may be that that's what people voted for and that's what they got. So we're going to do that, but we're going to do it with a panel of people to weigh this more. I'm speaking with Jared Yates Sexton. He's a professor of creative writing at Georgia Southern University, and his new book is out as well. It's called The People Are Going to Rise Like Waters Upon Your Shores. It hits shelves tomorrow. Jared sticks with us, but again, I want to encourage all listeners to give us your thoughts on what has happened in Charlottesville and what may have led up to it. How far back does this go? We're also going to talk about what is populism. We're going to break that down as well, but first, how radical politics are becoming mainstream. This is On Second Thought.
Life makes short work of all. Men take the change from beggars tied bound in sheets.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. We're talking about what led up to Donald Trump's election last November and how that connects or does not connect with what happened in Charlottesville over the weekend. With me to discuss the current state of affairs is New York Times columnist Brett Stevens. Hi there, Brett.
Nice to hear from you, Celeste.
Also with us is Carol Anderson, professor and chair of African American Studies at Emory University. Her latest book, White Rage, examines this widening racial divide in America. And still with us is Jared Yates Sexton. He's an author and professor of creative writing at Georgia Southern University. Hello, Jared, again, and hello, Carol.
Hi, Celeste.
Hello.
Brett, I want to start with you because Jared is... I think avowedly liberal. I mean, that's fair, Jared, right, to say that you're on the liberal end of the spectrum?
I think that's fair to say.
Okay. And so, Brett, you're on the conservative side. Jared is making...
I'm not sure what that means anymore, but go ahead. Yeah.
I was hoping you would explain it, but let's talk about the some of the connections people are making. And let me ask you the same question I asked Jared, which is it fair to blame Donald Trump for what happened in Charlottesville over the weekend?
I'm not sure if it's fair to blame the president for what happened in Charlottesville, but there's no question in my mind that the Trump campaign and the president himself, if you will, sort of lifted the lid on a sewer, and it came erupting out. And what you're seeing in Charlottesville is a piece of that. I mean, the president began legitimizing, in my view, some extraordinarily hateful rhetoric, normalizing a whole set of bigotries, which I thought some of us had hoped had sort of been cast to the very far fringes of society, and he brought them that much closer to the center. So in that sense, you don't want to blame someone for the act of one crazed guy, but there's a connection.
So, Carol, let me then play you a couple takes here on what's happening. The first one is just a portion of Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe's statement following Saturday's events. This was recorded by the Washington Post.
I remind you all that we are a nation of immigrants. Unless you're Native American, the first ships that came to Jamestown, Virginia in 1607. And since that time, many people have come to our great country to unite us. Our diversity, that mosaic tile of immigrants, is what makes us so special. And we will not let anybody come here and destroy it. So please go home and never come back.
Okay. Although they have to go home to somewhere in the United States. the second clip is from the CNN's interview with White House aide Tom Bossert. He is Trump's Homeland Security advisor.
These were people who showed up intentionally looking for trouble. These weren't people that showed up to protest a statue. I'm sure there were good people in the group that had various opinions on the removal or maintenance of the statue. But what they found when they showed up were groups from outside that showed up on both sides looking for trouble.
You're shaking your head, Carol. What do you make of this idea that we're talking about a small group of troublemakers on both sides?
That's a false equivalency. What we had was a militarized group of white supremacists who came to show their strength that they were going to take their country back and use the statue of Robert E. Lee, the Confederate general, as a symbol of what they were going to do to, in fact, flex the muscle that the president had in fact been signaling to them was absolutely okay. And let me just say, this false equivalency of the counter-protesters were not armed. The counter-protesters weren't the ones that the police were afraid of, had better weapons than they did.
Jared, your book discusses a lot about rage, this rage that is in some cases just sort of boiling up. And yet that same type of rage is something that people described helped to fuel Bernie Sanders' campaign. Is it a false equivalency to compare those two types of anger?
Well, I certainly saw a fair amount of anger from Bernie Sanders' base. Actually, at the Democratic National Convention, I watched them riot. I watched them threaten delegates going into the convention. So there were moments of rage, particularly on the left. But it was a lot smaller and less focused and less racist and xenophobic anger. It was more about the process. There's certainly been these instances of violence. They've certainly met a lot of these white supremacists, whether it's in Berkeley or in, I believe, Portland and now in Charlottesville. They've certainly met and had these small skirmishes. But these white supremacists basically have paramilitary groups now. They are training. They are openly admitting that they are going to these places to provoke violence. And I think that one is a reaction and the other is provocation.
So, Brett, I have this tweet from Doug Patton in Southwest Georgia who says, radical white supremacists found a safe space inside the GOP during 2016. It's only Trump who allows them to stay in the nest. What do you make, Brett, of this idea that what we are seeing is the fruition of the Southern strategy crafted all those years before by Nixon and his aides?
I don't buy that narrative simply because if you actually look at the Nixon administration's record on civil rights and that of subsequent Republican administrations, I don't think I don't see a chain between at least the Nixon presidency. I won't talk about his election in '68 and the present. I think Trump represents a real discontinuity from the conservative movement that I used to belong to, but there's no question that from the gentleman or the person who tweeted that's exactly right what Trump did, which is to say that he made a whole set of views, a whole set of bigotries, whether it was with respect to Muslims or Mexicans or women or other more individualized prejudices, more targeted prejudices, he made them palatable. He made them okay. And so that's exactly right. It created this sort of safe space in which people like, Spencer.
Richard Spencer,
Felt that he could, that he in a sense benefited from a kind of wink and nod relationship with the president and certain members of the administration. If you read this new book about Steve Bannon by Joshua Green called The Devil's Bargain, you'll see that Bannon was very inclusive when it came to the uglier elements of the alt-right and using them for tactical purposes. And whether the alliance was tactical or ideological, we'll find out. But it certainly opened up that space where these people feel like they are no longer at the fringes of society.
And yet, Brett, we have this tweet from Ted Barfield, and it's about you. He was protesting that you're not a bona fide conservative and says, quote, not really all that conservative, kind of David Brooks or Jennifer Rubin conservative, unquote. And this is a difficulty, especially for journalists, that at some point, how are we supposed to parse out who's a conservative voice and who isn't? It appears that in some people's minds, as soon as if you criticize the Trump administration, you're no longer considered conservative.
Well, I think the real ideological divide, not just in this country, but in the West at large, I'm speaking to you from Germany, where I now live much of the time, isn't really between liberal and conservative in the old sense. It's between liberal and illiberal, if you will. That's to say that, yeah, I mean, I'm 100% in favor of the First Amendment. I'm liberal in some social senses. If anyone had read my columns in the Wall Street Journal about Obama administration policy, whether it was the Iran deal or any other number of subjects, they wouldn't have. They probably would have thought of me as falling on the conservative side of the spectrum. But when it comes to Trump, he has. Flirted with a form of politics which I don't recognize as genuinely conservative. I recognize it as illiberal in the sense that it's not a respecter of the freedom of the press. It's not a respecter of freedom of religion. All those traditional freedoms that used to bind Americans of both political or all political persuasions, even if we differed on taxes and foreign policy and other issues. So I don't know what I don't know if I'm a David Brooks conservative. I try to just think for myself. But I used to be a conservative who was for smaller government, less regulation, fewer taxes, and so on. I still am. It's just the Republican Party that increasingly under Trump I don't recognize.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Brett Stevens, columnist for The New York Times, also Carol Anderson, professor of African-American studies at Emory, and Jared Yates Sexton, professor of creative writing at Georgia Southern. Carol, let me play you a comment from Barack Obama. He was speaking with CBS here. This is earlier. He is warning Trump and his administration not to break away from certain traditional practices in government.
The one thing I've said to him directly, and I would advise my Republican friends in Congress and supporters around the country, is just make sure that as we go forward, certain norms, certain institutional traditions don't get eroded, because there's a reason they're in place.
Carol, how do we weigh the distrust of government, which is kind of what Barack Obama is referring to there, and is felt across the political spectrum, with kind of what we're seeing when these norms and traditions break down?
And I think what you have here, this I would push back a bit on Bret Stephens, because it was in that moment of the Southern strategy where you started getting the tenets of what we're seeing erupting in Trump. So that this is a long time building. And Norm Ornstein and Thomas Mann wrote a brilliant book. It's even worse than it looks.
A conservative and a liberal, mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's even worse than it looks, because what they're talking about is what has happened to the Republican Party. And part of what has happened to the Republican Party is that the toxin of racism, white supremacy, was invited in via the Southern strategy, and it began to take over more and more and more, to the point where those kinds of traditional Republicans, those who valued small government, fiscal responsibility, and civil rights, where they no longer had a place because they couldn't get through the primary because of the toxin of white supremacy there. So you're seeing more and more of a push playing to that rabid, energized base of the Republican Party. And this is why you'll get a John McCain who has to bring on a Sarah Palin as his vice presidential running mate. And this is what laid the groundwork for Trump. And a key element in that norm shifting is, in fact, the role of government, because government was seen as being instrumental in implementing civil rights. And so there is a problem with government.
Jared, Carol's book was called White Rage. Your book is very much focused on rage. But the issue for me is that, how does one address rage? I mean, a rage is inherently illogical, right? And emotional. How does one deal with it?
That's a wonderful question. And I wish that I had a succinct, proven answer to deal with that question. The only thing that I know is that when I'm talking to my relatives, when I'm talking to my family, when I'm talking to people from my community back in Indiana, I have to talk to them on a personal level. I have to bridge the gap of ambiguity. I have to let them know, for instance, with these neo-Nazis, that they have threatened me. They have threatened my family. They have done these awful things. And once you put a human face on the situation, and particularly a face of someone they know, it makes a difference. But on a larger scale in this country, we have a lot of problems, economic, social, political, that we're not having real conversations about the roots of these things, because they're very difficult and they're very nuanced. And we're living in a soundbite culture in which most people want an easy and direct answer. And the easiest and most direct answer is to be angry. And once people start pointing out who to be angry at, that takes care of the conversation. And so as a result, we have to have these difficult, nuanced conversations. But how we do that is a great question.
Brett, let me let you answer that same question. Not to get a soundbite for you or an easy direct answer, but if rage is what's fueling what we're seeing right now, and it appears as though without some action, it could very easily get worse, what do we do?
Well, look, you know, I mean, I'm always moved by Lincoln's first inaugural address, which concludes with that beautiful peroration, calling on us to summon the better angels of our nature. And typically, it has been the role of statesmanship in the United States to do exactly that. You think of George W. Bush in the immediate wake of 9/11, reaching out to the Muslim community, making sure that it would not be targeted and stereotyped, and that he wouldn't lead a crusade against Islam. Now it's more difficult because you just don't have that kind of administration. You have an administration that is sort of sort of leaning on surrogates to make the right sounding noises while the president is absent without leave. I think it's very important, not just for presidents, former presidents like Barack Obama, but also for the two former president, the two Bushes, and other senior Republican figures who have honorable records when it comes to matters of civil rights and calling out and bigots on the right and on the fringes of the Republican Party for sort of claiming the Republican Party for themselves. Yeah. And if the president isn't going to do it, it's vital that voices on the right do that. So far, I think they have. But it's very difficult when you're dealing with a president who is constantly flirting with not the better angels of our nature, but with with our very worst instincts. It's a depressing verdict, but that's why I was opposed to Trump from the beginning and remain appalled by his presidency today.
That's Brett Stevens, columnist for The New York Times. Also, Jared Yates Sexton, author and professor at Georgia Southern, and Carol Anderson of Emory University. Her latest book is White Rage, and the paperback hit shelves on April 5th. Thanks to all three of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jared is going to stay with us. Just ahead, we talk about populism. It's on Second Thought. It's on Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Tomorrow we talk about why kids playing football get so many concussions. And we'd love to hear you weigh in on this. Are there any sports you will not let your kids play? And what do you do to protect your children from getting injured? Call and let us know. It's 404-500-9457. You can also find us on social media, but be sure to join us at 9 a.m. tomorrow morning for more. Some say our president is a populist. Some say he absolutely is not. To understand the debate over this, you must make sure you know what populism is. So, let's break it down. Ooh, break it down, baby, because I want y'all all to know. Let me break it down for you again. Break it down now. Break it down. Google defines populism as appealing to or being aimed at ordinary people. There is a political definition as well, the belief that average people should have more say in governance than the wealthy elite.
You want some of my electricity, do you? Well, for once, the rich white man is in control.
And there's a much more complicated definition. We'll spend the next few minutes explaining that one. Populism, like so many words, has a Latin root. Populus means people, in the sense of a large, unspecific group of persons. The masses. Populism as a political philosophy dates back to Imperial Rome. One faction in the Roman Senate was known as the populares. They tried to determine the people's will by presenting referenda that bypassed the Senate. Thanks to Shakespeare and the Bible, you probably know some members of the populares factions, Julius Caesar and Caesar Augustus.
I demand only this, that you join with me in building a new Rome, a Rome that offers justice, peace, and land to all its citizens, not just the privileged few.
Populism is not just a political concept, though. The Anabaptists of 16th century Europe were populists who believed everyone, including peasants, should be able to read the Bible for themselves. This was regarded by some as heresy.
Well, I was thinking, we could turn the homeless into tires so that we'd still have homeless, but we could use them on our cars.
Oh, that's a good one.
Nice one, Randy.
Like it.
That's like recycling.
The English Civil War of the 1600s was a populist revolt. It ended with the king beheaded, his successor exiled, and the English monarchy interrupted. The Commonwealth was born in 1649. The French Revolution was sort of a populist revolt. A lot of the wealthy elite lost their heads, but it was led by privileged intellectuals and supported by a majority of the common folk. The Nazis earned populism a bad name in Germany.
Many tens of thousands of the best leadership personnel of Europe have been exterminated. Bodies stacked one upon the other were found outside the crematory. The Nazis maintained a building at the camp for medical experiments and vivisections with prisoners as guinea pigs.
The philosophical and prejudicial foundation of the National Social German Workers' Party was based on hatred and a perverted dedication to das Volk, the people. They believed the Jews were a threat to their republic. The Holocaust was the result. Populism is neither liberal nor conservative.
The system is dead.
Dad, the system's not dead. It's just that for the first time in your life, you're on the outside looking in. And do you know what that means, Dad? You and I are finally on the same side.
You're right. So what do?
We stick it to the man.
Silvio Berlusconi's right-wing Italian government was populist. Nigel Farage's radical right party in the UK is also a populist party. To make it a little more confusing, Farage and his party fought hard for Brexit. But the leader of the Brexit opposition party, the Labour Party, is Jeremy Corbyn, and he's part of a left-leaning populist party. Here at home, both Bernie Sanders on the left and Donald Trump on the right were said to be populists. They both campaigned on the overthrow of established political leaders in favor of the people's will.
We don't want you making any major bar decisions alone anymore because you're sleazy and we don't trust you.
Yeah, we want to vote on things now, okay? We want a democracy.
Well, that ain't gonna work because you guys get really emotional about everything and nothing will get done.
Calling someone a populist is not always a compliment.
You wanted to be safe from the government, so you became a stupid government.
It can imply playing on the emotions of the masses and manipulating crowds to achieve extreme goals.
Mrs. Griffin, what do you plan to do about crime in our city?
A lot. Because that's what Jesus wants. 9/11 was bad.
I agree with that.
Hugo Chavez, former Venezuela president, was a populist who used his power to establish a strong-arm regime. As the New York Times reported, populism is a path that, at its outset, can look and feel democratic, but followed to its logical conclusion, it can lead to democratic backsliding or even outright authoritarianism.
I am a cop, and you will respect my authority.
Yeah, right. You better get back to school, little boy.
Ow! Get your ass in jail!
Ow! Hey, what the hell are you doing? You can't do that! Ow!
Clearly, populism is a nuanced concept. We have some experts with us to talk about populism. With us now is Cass Mutta. He's professor in the Department of International Affairs at UGA, and he's author of the book Fighting the System: Populist Radical Right Parties and Party System Change. Hi there.
Good morning.
And also with us still is Jared Yates Sexton, author and professor at Georgia Southern. It's good to have you still with us, Jared.
Thank you.
So, Cass, let's start with this. The first question. We're both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders populists?
So I think actually neither was populist, and only Donald Trump became a populist during the campaign. And so I think one of the major problems with the term populism is that it's used too broadly, and obviously it has become kind of a political weapon. But if you see populism as an ideology which sees society as being divided ultimately between two groups, which are homogenous and antagonistic, the pure people on the one hand and the corrupt elite on the other. Then the division that is moral and not about interest, I don't think Bernie Sanders was a populist.
Jared, do you go along with that? Because oftentimes populism, a populist leader can use the strong feelings of masses of people to gain power. Is that, do your mind, an essential component of populism?
Well, I think one of the things that we're seeing, particularly in the past few years, is we're seeing words starting to be stretched to the point where they lose their entire meaning. When we're talking about Donald Trump, a billionaire who lives in a golden tower, and we're starting to call him a populist, I think what we're talking about is populism with quotes around it, which is more of a product. It's almost like trying to sell Pepsi to people. It doesn't mean what it used to mean. Now it means I'll say or try and stoke these sort of feelings, but meanwhile, he's putting Goldman Sachs people in his administration. He hasn't really, I would say, passed any legislation that's been focused on helping people so much as helping businesses and corporations. This is now a product. It is a front for something else, and I think populism doesn't really apply in this case.
Cass, I want to read you a comment that we got on Facebook from one of our listeners, because there are a lot of people sort of making a connection between populism and identity politics. So here's what Leonard Henry says. He says, your commentators regarding racism and what transpired in Charlottesville miss half the problem, that the liberal left and Democratic Party have promoted identity politics and a balkanization of America under the guise of diversity. What we are seeing is an expression of identity from a very angry white politic that has felt itself marginalized for several decades, shoved aside by programs like affirmative action, however well-meaning that program was. Identity politics is a very dangerous game. What is the difference, if any, between identity politics and populism?
Well, to a certain extent, populism goes beyond identity politics in the sense that it defines all the people as one and as being sharing the same values and sharing the same interest. And so it believes that any type of identity beyond that is secondary, which doesn't only include like racial or ethnic identity, but also gender. The question at the moment is that most of the populist parties and politicians that are really successful in the West combine populism with nativism, which is very strongly defined on the basis of ethnic identity, and particularly white, or in the European context, more national identity.
Why does nativism and populism so often end up in the same party?
Well, in part because when you speak about the people, you by and large speak about the majority, and in most countries, the majority is at least implicitly defined ethnically, or in the U.S., racially. And so it makes kind of sense that you would collapse the two, but it's not necessary. So Hugo Chavez in Venezuela or Alexis Tsipras in Greece are left-wing populists who didn't push this type of nativism or identity politics. And I do believe that the Facebook comment is very spot on. We focus increasingly on populism when we actually talk about nativism and racism, and they're not the same.
What do you make of that, Jared? I mean, you went to all of these campaign rallies. You heard from a lot of people who spoke to you about what's fueling their rage. Is it identity politics?
Well, first of all, I just want to say that I couldn't disagree more with that comment. I think
the comment that I read from Facebook.
From Facebook. This idea of identity politics, which has turned into a slanderous term, what we're actually talking about are two groups of people who are in opposition over what is happening in reality. We have a group of people on one hand that see a patriarchal, systematic, racist culture, and another hand that says, that doesn't exist, I do not have these opportunities, I don't have these advantages, these privileges. What we're actually seeing now is on the right, particularly with Trump's base, is its own brand of what you would call identity politics. We now have a group of people who are united under the idea of Trump that there is not this patriarchal, systematic, racist culture. And they have bound together to reinforce this reality. So in fact, when they're saying that identity politics is the problem, they're engaging in their own brand of that.
And we did get this tweet from Felix, who says, listening from Canada, I'm struck by constant insistence on party affiliation before ideas. Cass, is populism associated with either the liberal or the conservative end of the spectrum?
Well, the American terms are a little bit different from the rest of the world. But it's not necessarily on the right. It's not necessarily conservative. And they're actually elitism, which believes actually that the people should have limited power, is traditionally much more conservative than liberal. What we have seen since pretty much the late 1980s, first in Western Europe, then Eastern Europe, and now we see it in North America, is that populism has been particularly successful on the right, where it is combined with nativism and authoritarianism. And I think you see that in at least the campaign of Trump and also his presidency in terms of rhetoric.
So Cass just said that Trump's campaign combines populism with nativism and authoritarianism. Do you agree with that, Jared?
Yeah, I think he's dead on. What we saw is a lot of rhetoric that was built off decades of basically Republican doublespeak, which is the Republican ideology goes back to the idea of free markets, interventionism, corporations, these sort of ideas. And the Republicans have had to play this game where they can't always necessarily say what they intend in terms of economics because it is not populist. So what we've seen beginning with Nixon's silent majority and moving on to Reagan and George W. Bush and now Donald Trump is this sort of doublespeak. But Donald Trump has not even engaged in doublespeak. He's just blatantly said these things that I don't think he's in favor of, and we have not seen borne out in his administration. And it's got that touch of authoritarianism that is stoking that anger that's been there for years and that disappointment over not seeing populist ideas and policies for helping these people. So I think that anger is part of that authoritarianism that we're seeing from Trump.
So, Cass, a lot of our listeners are still stuck with this idea of which party is sort of behind the rage. We have this email from Carl Owens, who says, "All your guests today blame the Republican Party and Trump for racist trouble in our country. This is simple-minded, shows a bias toward the liberal viewpoint. Our country is mostly conservative to some degree, and starting these discussions from the left immediately turns some off to a healthy debate." Where does populism fit into this idea over who the people are in the United States? Because that seems to be sort of the crux of the problem, right? Who is America? Who is the majority of America?
Yeah, but populism doesn't necessarily speak that much to it because both left and right populists in share this idea that the people are kind of amorphous, but they are all morally pure. You see the distinction between the left populism, which has a more inclusive, ethnically inclusive people, and generally the right, at least the radical right, which has a more exclusive definition of the people, where the term the people is combined with the nation. But these are different things. As said, populism doesn't have to be nativist or racist. It can be inclusive, as we see in Greece or in Spain. I do take issue with this false equivalence, though, the whole time about that the threat doesn't come from the right or that the divisive politics doesn't come from the right. And I do totally agree with Jared on that. The U.S. has a very long history within the Republican Party and before that within the Democratic Party as well of this type of nativist politics.
That you just heard the voice of Cass Mutta. He's professor in the Department of International Affairs at UGA. And Jared Yates Sexton is author and professor of creative writing at Georgia Southern. He's been with us all this hour, and his book is called The People Are Going to Rise Like the Waters Upon Your Shore. It's released tomorrow. Cass and Jared, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Celeste.
We're still getting a lot of comments from you, and we want to get more of them. Alex Safe Cummings says, "Populism intersects with racism simply because some people believe only white people are truly the people." We would love to get your thoughts on this. The rage that has bubbled up in the United States, from whatever side that it is, we would love to hear what you think causes it. You know how to reach us, 404-500-9457, or find us on social media. Tell us your thoughts about Charlottesville, what led to Charlottesville, and where we should go now. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.
Yeah, it's fine.